Welcome, everybody. Episode 9 of the Peter Schrager Podcast. What a fun ride it's been. Last week, we had a great pair of guests, Jeremy Shockey and Laura Oakman. This week, we have another great pair of guests. But I'm going to start with my impressions from the NFL weekend that was. Week 10 was interesting, huh? I mean, you've got the Rams coming out there and putting a whooping on the Colts in Indianapolis. You've got the Jaguars beating the Titans in Tennessee. And then you've got the Panthers going out all the way to the West Coast and beating the 49ers, who were red hot in San Francisco. It was the week of the road underdog. Now, Sunday, I was at the Ravens-Bengals game. I'm standing on the sideline ready to get a post-game interview with Torrey Smith with about 10 seconds left to go. And I look over at a Ravens player and I nod my head and I say, "Hey, that's a good win." And he looks at me and says, "It ain't over yet." Well, 5 seconds later, Andy Dalton goes back, throws a Hail Mary. It's caught. They go to overtime. I was ready to dig a hole, climb in it, and never come out. I was mortified for what I said on that sideline, but sure enough, they did get the victory. Incredible game. And just to give you a perspective on what it's like in an NFL locker room, that sideline after that play, you know, yes, they were defeated. Yes, they were deflated. A lot of guys went down on their knees and, "Oh my God." But they had a game to play, and those guys did. Jimmy Smith is a third-year corner, former first-round pick out of Colorado. Not the most vocal guy, kind of a laid-back California chill type. He was fired up. He was screaming at his teammates, "Let's go, let's go." Haloti Ngata, not a huge talker. He was screaming at his teammates, "Let's go." What I saw from the Ravens there, those were two guys who stepped up for holes that Ed Reed, Ray Lewis, Bernard Pollard, guys like that that used to play that role for the Ravens. I saw it with my own eyes. Terrell Suggs, Elvis Dumervil, they all elevated. They all stepped up. The offense is a mess in Baltimore, but they're now 4-5. They've got the Bears without Jay Cutler this weekend. They've got the Jets the following weekend at home, and then they've got the Steelers at home on Monday night. Three very winnable games. Then you're looking at a 7-5 defending champion team going into December. Don't count out the Ravens yet. Those are my big impressions. And then you got the NFC where it's wide open. I think the Seahawks are the one seed, but man, when the Saints blow out the Cowboys like that, the Giants have a big win. They now get the Packers without Aaron Rodgers, and then they get the Cowboys up ahead the week after that. NFC is wide open after that Saints-Seahawks bundle right there, because there's wild card spots or divisions to be won. I love the NFL. Love the NFL. It's great. Great, great week. I am excited for the next one. Our first guest this week is one of the most interesting guys that I've ever come across and made one of the most interesting decisions you might not know about this past week. While everyone else was talking about another John, who's an offensive lineman, John Martin, I was fascinated with the story of John Moffitt. John Moffitt is joining us today on the podcast. John, you are now in Seattle, Washington, but you made news last week for a different reason. You came out and said you were quitting the NFL after 3 years, and the quote in USA Today was, "I'm not happy at all." You were with the Denver Broncos, who were 8-1 at the time. You left the team. Take us through that decision and the courage you have right now to walk away from a game while you still could be being paid very handsomely to play that game.
I think it was a thing over time, and probably over the, I don't know, past 5-6 months, it's kind of been weighing on me. And finally it got to a boiling point, and I started really looking at it about a month ago and kind of trying to explore other options. And, you know, when we went home for the bye week, I really, really thought about it and just said, you know something, I don't love this game. I don't have to do it anymore. And basically, you know, like Billy Madison, I'm not going to school on Monday.
Beautiful.
I never went in, you know, and that was kind of it. So.
Now, you signed a 4-year contract back when you were the 75th overall pick in 2011 by the Seattle Seahawks, traded to the Broncos. A lot of people would say, man, you're getting paid millions of dollars to play to play. You're walking away. You've got mind and body and your health right now. What was the pros and cons of this decision, especially doing it midseason?
I think that for me, there were no cons at all, because I, you know, really lost my passion, and I just don't really care to play football anymore. You know, I played so much football, and, you know, I've had so many people say to me, you know, like you say, you know, how can you walk away from the money and so on and so forth. And, you know, I think people like to compare, like, with their jobs. But the only difference is that their job, they can't get physically maimed. You know what I mean? And I think that was a very valid part of my decision. To me, after I lost the passion, it wasn't worth money to risk my physical health, you know?
It's fascinating. Were you aware of all the physical things, or is it just the last couple years where you're watching a frontline piece called League of Denial, or you're seeing all the ex-players, you're seeing Tony Dorsett with the CTE? It's just fascinating for a current player to raise his hand and say, I know I can do this. I'm choosing not to for the long term. You are the first guy that I've seen do that. I find it fascinating. You're setting a precedent here. Was it the recent news that came out, or was it for years building, like, hey, I'm getting hurt here and there. I want to have my mind and my body in 10 years down the line.
Yeah, I really, you know, so the Tony Dorsett thing just happened to come out right when I did. I was not aware of that, you know, and I honestly didn't really think, you know, I never put it in the perspective that I was the first guy to do this. I kind of put it in the perspective of I'm a backup. I don't think anybody will care. I'm going to slip out the back door. No one will even notice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And apparently that didn't happen. So I guess and that is true. I guess no one has done that. I didn't really realize. But for me, it was just, you know, I was becoming steadily aware, and there were things that were being said, and there were things that I was seeing myself that I was like, okay, this is a violent game, like, no question. I mean, we always knew it was a violent game, but I'm like, the repercussions might be a little bit more than what we think. And the thing that really stuck with me, there were always a few things that stuck with me. I mean, obviously, I blew my knee out when I was a rookie. You know, I've had my fair share of injuries in just 2.5 years. I had 2 surgeries and, you know, a lot of other stuff. And to me, I just said, you know, the thing that stuck with me was, it's not the big collisions to the head. It's the consistent every play hits to your head that can really affect you. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of exactly what an offensive lineman is, just a consistent hit every play, you know?
How many years have you been playing football your life?
Since I was 8.
Since you were 8, you were a star at the high school level. You went to Wisconsin where you were a stud on a very decorated offensive line, drafted by the Seahawks and John Schneider and Pete Carroll, playing with guys like Russell Okung, just talented offensive line. Then you go to the Broncos and you get to play with Peyton Manning. You're 7-1 and you decide, Super Bowl, I don't care. I'm done. You know, people say, how could you not wait till the end of the season? Your response to that?
I think you nailed it. Like, when you really don't care about something, and I'm not trying to be like, you know, I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything, because I know a lot of people care about this. So I'm not trying to disrespect the things that they care about. And at the same time, I'm also not trying to criticize the choice that men make to play football. You know what I mean? This is just a personal choice. And for me personally, I didn't care about the Super Bowl. I didn't care that we were on a 7-1 team. You know, I really liked Peyton, but I didn't, you know, the things that probably I should have felt, I was not feeling. I mean, you just, you know, you can't control that. And to me, I just, you know, I'm very happy now because I finally started making choices for myself in my life, you know, and not for, like, what you're supposed to feel, what you're supposed to think, what you're supposed to say. And once you start really being you, you can't go wrong, you know?
I mean, this is like existential stuff. I mean, really, you're mature beyond your years saying this. And I think you talk to anyone at any job in America who hates their job and comes to work and has that lunch pail attitude where it's, oh, my God, when does this end? They wish they could retire. You have that opportunity because you have some money saved up. You make that decision. Now, I'm sure people have come at you on Twitter, in real life, and said, man, I would trade positions with you in a second. What's your response to that?
I mean, it's to me, again, you know, how much money is enough money? That was something I thought about. There was a lot of things that went into my decision. Like, I don't want to sit there and just say there was one thing. Like, I was worried that I was going to be brain dead, or I was, you know, just didn't care about money, or I just didn't, you know, it was all across the whole board. And, you know, I really said to myself, how much money do you need?
Yeah.
How much is enough? You know, I was like, I don't even know if I really want to be a millionaire, honestly. I think where I'm at I think money and the need for money and the need for security is all just an illusion. It's not real, because as we know, anything can happen. People lose 401ks, you know, the whole economy collapses. In 2008, people were losing their houses and everything. It's an illusion. It's just an illusion, and especially based on this economic system we're in right now. So to me, I was like, you know what? I made enough money. I'm healthy, and I just want to be happy, and there's so many things in life that I want to do that I can't do because of football, like weigh 250 pounds. I'd like to weigh 250 pounds, you know?
What are you weighing now?
So I started losing weight already. I went on the diet as soon as I quit football.
I mean, it's unhealthy. No matter what anyone thinks, it's unhealthy to weigh 300 pounds. It just is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Yeah, without a doubt. I'll tell you from personal experience, it's totally unhealthy. It's just, you know, it's too much weight. It's too much weight. And so now I just started, you know, just basically eating way less, dieting the whole thing. And I'm probably like 300 even right now. So
yeah.
Probably about 50 pounds to go, you know. But in Seattle, I played at like 325.
Yeah.
And at Wisconsin, I think I was like 340 at times because, you know, beer and cheese curds.
So yeah, as you said, beer and cheese curds. How many calories a day does a typical offensive lineman take in? And like, what's your diet during the season? I ask curiously because we see a Gilbert Brown or we see a Dontari Poe and we're like, whoa, that guy is huge. But that's work to stay at that weight.
Yeah, I think it's. You know, it is work, but it's like an enjoyable work because you're just eating. Like for me, I was like, I'd just black out and just eat like two dinners. You know what I mean? It's just a blur of just constant, you know, you're always eating to stay big. And there'd be times where I'd eat normal and lose 5 to 10 pounds. I'm like, all right, I got to go eat, you know, and then you go out to dinner and eat, you know, you eat two dinners, you know? And hey, I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it because I did.
Yeah.
But it was,
good cuisine out in Seattle. Yeah.
Oh, delicious. You know, and you can imagine how much sushi you could eat at 300 pounds, you know? So.
You talk about walking away from the game and making this decision, but whereas other people, when they check out at their job mentally and they're just not into it, they can still clock in, collect a paycheck. If you clock out mentally as an offensive lineman, you're putting some people's lives at risk. When you were playing for the Broncos this year, how do you balance that thing of, I don't want to do this anymore, but if I don't do this at 100% when I'm on the field, Peyton Manning gets injured.
Right. That's how I feel. You know, that was the crazy thing. A lot of people told me when I didn't publicly say I was going to retire, I just told like my agent and some other people. And they were literally just like, just tough it out for like 6 more months and collect the paycheck and then be done.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you know, first off, that's not really the kind of person that I want to be anymore. You know, if you're going to make a move like this, why would you sacrifice who you were just for 6 months more of pay? You know what I mean? And on top of that, I think that, like, and that's a great point that you made, and you took the words right out of my head. Let's say I go back, right, and the O-line is banged up, and then I go in,
mm-hmm.
and my passion level is like 60, 70%, right? Because I always enjoyed playing the game when I was in there. I loved it. But in all reality, you go in and then, you know, Peyton Manning's your quarterback, you know, and realistically, I wouldn't want to put him in danger.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's, I don't know if I would. I would like to say about myself that I did take pride when I did play, hence why I'm not playing right now, you know?
When you stepped away, did the NFLPA call you and try to convince you otherwise? Did they ask you, why are you doing this? Please don't do this. So what was the response from the players' union?
It was pretty interesting. they called me a few times, and some of the stuff that they, you know, just to be blunt, I think they did a really terrible job, and I just don't...
Terrible job overall or terrible job with this situation in particular?
With my situation.
Okay, go on.
You know, I can't really speak to them overall, but I would just say, you know, I got called probably 4 or 5 times from them, from 3 different people. So I think that's just odd, and no one ever said anything different every time. There was never anything different said. So I don't know. You can take that as it is. And there were things in that conversation that, you know, maybe one day I'd like to talk about, but right now is probably not the, you know, the right time. But it was the whole thing was, you know, it definitely wasn't. I would not call the NFLPA like an assisting force for me.
They weren't supportive of this decision.
No.
Yeah.
So
we're going through this Jonathan Martin case, and I almost feel like you're watching this from the sidelines, just kind of probably shaking your head. You're an offensive lineman, or were an offensive lineman. I don't think we as the outside can really just understand the bond and the relationship amongst the offensive line group. I'll just say from my experience as a writer, you walk into a locker room, you got the receivers over there, they're busting each other's chops, you got the quarterbacks mm-hmm. together, and then you walk to the back corner and there are just a pack of 300-pound animals just busting each other's chops nonstop. It's like you don't even want to go near that group because A, they hate the media, B, they're a fraternity amongst themselves. What is it like being a part of an offensive line group?
You really did nail it, though. And it's always it's kind of like being like in a little cult, you know? And I would always get a lot of guff because I like to talk to everybody.
Yeah.
And I was kind of more, I was all over the place and everything. So they kind of considered me like a black sheep of the O-line. But I like the media and I like talking to people, you know what I mean? So I was kind of the black sheep, but just like you said, it's cultish, you know? Don't talk to anybody. Only with us. This is the group right here. Nobody else exists. They just happen to be on the field. You know what I mean?
Yep. Now, when you see this stuff with Martin and Incognito, does it blow your mind, or is you could see that possibly happening?
I don't know. I've never personally experienced that. I was in great locker rooms. You know, Seattle and Denver, really, I mean, great organizations. Both organizations are great to me. Both organizations had great guys in the locker room. So I personally never experienced that. The thing I find funny about the Incognito and Jonathan Martin thing is just there's so much like back and forth and disinformation and I think there's so much stuff that they're just trying to feed to save Richie Incognito because they don't want a clear cut bullying mess.
Yeah.
Right? Because we're on this big anti bullying thing around the country. So like I feel like they need to validate Martin but at the same time save Richie's face. You know what I mean?
It's a tough spot for the PA and the players in that Miami locker room, I could tell you to a man, are in support of Richie Incognito. Now, whether they really feel that way or whatever, but they, on a public platform, they're saying Richie's their brother, their teammate, whatever. However, the PA has to protect Jonathan Martin as well. So it's a tricky spot. As a lineman yourself, if this was to go on one of your teams, whether how ridiculous it might sound, when one guy steps out against the others, I mean, you could see where he can kind of be disenfranchised and put on the fringe.
I find it all very peculiar that the whole team's in support of Richie when the coaches, possibly put Richie up to this. You know what I mean? And at the same time, I just think, I don't know all the details of the case. All I know is that I heard a phone call from Richie, and it was disgusting.
Yeah.
You know? So that's all I really know about it. And then I know that another grown man had to leave the team because he felt so, however he felt. I don't know. Again, I don't know, So I think it's a mess for the NFL personally. I think
yeah.
The NFL, it's what a tornado that hit the NFL this week. And I think maybe that's why I'm wrapped up in this. I've been trying to figure out why my, thing is so, and obviously, like you said, I guess it's the first person, but I think that, I left the league, Richie Incognito, Tony Dorsett comes out and says, how bad condition his brain is in. So the NFL is kind of in a real spot right now.
It's interesting. It's what's fascinating is that everyone's saying, well, now the NFL can now be the leader in anti-bullying. Well, the NFL already has to fight the concussions. They already have to fight the Redskins name. They already have to fight the ex-players.
Yeah.
How many fronts can they fight at once? Now they're supposed to be the leaders in the anti-bullying thing. It's amazing to me. And all the while, the NFL is making a lot of money. The bottom line is very good. The TV deals are very good. So as far as all these outside things with public opinion are going, at the bottom line, it seems like they're doing just fine.
Yeah. The NFL is doing more than fine. I mean, I think the concussion thing is such a joke. I mean, if you look at the settlement and how it worked, I mean, they're going to make that money and times, how much more on interest, over that 20-year payout. And then on top of that, I heard that a lot of the things that they didn't even tell the truth on, or some of the concussions of it's not even really coming out. And it's the same kind of stuff they do with their books. Like, when you talk about splitting revenue, I mean, they never open their books in the CBA. This is just a question because I'm not a finance guy.
Yeah.
If you never open your books, right, how do I know if I'm getting the right percentage of the money? All we know is media and TV dollars, but all the other money, you don't know, right?
Mike, I guess you were a You were drafted during the lockout, I suppose. Was that right?
Yeah.
So you're drafted during the lockout. So when you were in Seattle, who was the NFLPA rep? Was it Michael Robinson? Was he the guy, or who was the team rep?
Yeah, he was the player rep.
All right. So former fullback. I think he's back with the team actually. Michael Robinson out of Penn State was the rep. He had 32 of these reps. They were all very veteran players. Did you feel like you were informed as well as you should have been from the PA and from the reps as far as what was going on with that lockout and whether that was for your best interest?
Because I was drafted that year, we were really not even included.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know anything. I mean, I literally got drafted and then sat home until camp, until they came back and the deal was done. So there was like I had no clue.
Yeah.
You know? And it's kind of, the whole thing is very, I think it's very interesting to me. It was rushed and done with haste, and, you know, they knew time was of the essence, and they kind of used it against everybody. And I guarantee you the owners got a really, really great deal and way better than people even know.
Well, sure. And look, the same thing with the rush and the haste. The concussion settlement, $765 million, whatever it was, there are guys who need help and health insurance and need all this stuff now. And there was a risk and a threat of not getting any money at all. So I think the same kind of thing played out there where they eventually said, you know what, there's $765 million out there. We have guys who need this money. Let's sign the deal. But you're right. They'll make that money back. It's a sliver of what they're really making.
No, you know, and do you know that I was just told this the other day, all the NFL teams, they're going to be the ones to pay that money, the concussion money, because they can write it off. The NFL can't because it's a nonprofit organization. The NFL is a nonprofit organization, by the way, in case anybody wanted to know that, which I find very interesting as well.
Does it enrage you when you see this kind of stuff? I mean, you're an educated guy. You're obviously, you take deep thought, and I don't think all the players look into it as much. They just think, hey, we got a game on Sunday. When you look at it all from the big picture, does it enrage you as a former player?
Yeah, it does. Because it's dirty business. You know, it's all dirty business. And the worst part about it is, I mean, all business is dirty business. Let's be honest. Like, let's look at corporate America and what they try to instill in people. Like, it's such a big deal that I leave the NFL. That's how I feel brainwashed people are with money and that false sense of security. But not only is the NFL dirty regular corporate business, but now you're risking people's health. You know, I mean, what other business, what other workplace in the world do you – can you blow, say you're walking, you know, down the office and you hit a computer chair and you blow your knee out, right? And then you're not taken care of ever. Like I blew my knee out and I think my settlement was like $5,000, you know, because I got the what's it called lawyer and it was just, you know, you're not appropriately taken care of with major injuries and even stuff like that because they don't want to affect profit margins or whatever else they do, you know? But I know I am not a financial guy. I'm not like a smart, you know, like I don't understand all the financial things, but I do understand the basics. And I know if I just basically look at this system, there's something really, really wrong about it.
We're with John Moffitt, who just stepped away from the game, probably at the prime of his career, 3 years in, making good money with the Broncos on a team that's going to probably go deep into the playoffs, could have made more money with those playoff bonuses. John steps away from the game at the bye week, 7-1 at the time. You know, what would you change about the game if you were to be the commissioner for a day that maybe would look out for the players' interests a little bit better?
I mean, what I would like to see for players is a new CBA. I would like to see a brand new CBA.
We're just 2 years into a 10-year deal, man.
I know, but that's okay because, I mean, if players remember, they can just walk away too. You know, referees walked away last year, and that did a lot. So could you imagine what a player's walking away would do? I bet you'd only have to walk away for two games.
That's
you
a good
know?
Point.
And it's just, I mean, I would do so much. It wouldn't even be, I would want to be the commissioner in the NFL because I just think some of the things about the NFL are just so bad. I mean, how is it a nonprofit organization? How?
Now,
I don't get that.
And, you know, you walked away, but you see all this stuff from the outside now, but you played for two of the most player-friendly coaches you could ever ask for. Pete Carroll loves his guys. He'll go to bat for those guys. John Fox is known as the player's coach. As far as being in an NFL locker room and the mentality that you guys have, you weren't anything against those two coaches, though, were you?
No, not at all. And that's, you know, when I talk about this stuff, I'm talking about organizational stuff. I'm talking about bureaucracy, and I'm talking about, you know, the NFL as a corporation. Pete Carroll, John Fox, great guys. John Fox, I was there for 2 months. He was great to me. Pete has always been great to me, and I really love the way that he coaches and the people that he puts in that locker room, because they're great people. And I love the people in the NFL. So I don't have an issue with that, but I do think that I have, you know, I've been asked all these questions by people who really would like honest answers, and most of the people they ask, they can't get honest answers because players can't do it. And now I'm not a player anymore, and I'm asked a question, and I would like to honestly answer it, you know?
You watched games this weekend, or you just stayed away from football altogether?
I watched a little bit.
How weird was it for the first weekend since you were 8 years old watching football from the sidelines?
It was awesome.
You loved it.
It was awesome.
You loved it.
Yeah. I'm done, man. It was awesome. I watched the Seahawks, watched a little bit of the Broncos, and it was cool, man. It was a lot of fun. I just sat on my couch and hung out, had a few beers, and just enjoyed it, you know? And it's fun to be a fan of the NFL. I'll tell you that much. It's fun to be a fan of the NFL.
You get it now, right?
Of course. It's fun.
Yeah, you know, and I was at the Vikings Redskins on Thursday night, and I was talking to Chris Cooley, the former tight end. He was there hanging around afterwards, and I said, "Do you miss it?" He goes, "No, I don't miss it. I get to watch it, and guess what? The next morning, I can walk." You know, and that's how he was feeling. You seem to have the same kind of sentiment on this one. I guess, have you heard from any of your teammates? Did any of those guys call you a quitter? Did any of those guys roll their eyes? Have you heard from them, or was there support from within the organization with both the Broncos and the Seahawks for you stepping away?
I think there was. I think, you know, most people have been really good about it, you know, and I think that when you explain to guys, I think guys inside understand. You know, I'm back in Seattle, so I've seen a bunch of my friends that are on the Hawks. And, you know, when I left Denver, I texted a few of the guys in the offensive line and just said, "Hey, you know, it was great getting to know you." And they were all very supportive. You know, they're like, "You're crazy, but you're following your heart and you understand." And, you know, the Seahawks guys, they all get it because I think they kind of know me. And it's been, you know, those guys are friends. Those are good people. So it's, the support has been good on that end, you know. And you know, the quitter thing, I really haven't heard that. I've heard that more from, like, you know, like people asking, "Are you worried about being a quitter?" You know?
Yeah.
And no. Not at all.
You seem like you've got a, you know, and I don't want to label you here, but you seem like you've got a pretty good idea about who you are and what you want to do and what kind of person as far as values that you are. Now, playing offensive line, that you're in the trenches. You have to be a dirty dog down there. Did you have that in you, or you flip the switch and you could take a guy's knees out, or you could flip the switch and you can talk trash? Like, were you that kind of player?
If I got mad, yeah. I have a little bit of a temper, you know what I mean? So if we were playing, it could happen, yeah. And I think I played the game the way it was supposed to be played, you know. I think you could ask coaches around the league, and I could have played a lot longer. So I did have that. And, you know, it's just something that, you know, you can kind of turn on. You kind of almost have to if you're going to play the game.
It's unsafe if you don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's just sometimes you just have to, you know, I'm not saying take a guy's knees out, but sometimes you have to. If you're going to talk trash, the next play you're going to get really violent. Sometimes you just need to, you know?
Yeah. You were in that Hail Mary game, Packers-Seahawks, last year. What are your memories of that game, which is one of the craziest moments maybe in the last 5 years in the NFL? What was your reaction when Golden Tate comes down with that questionable touchdown?
Oh, my God. I remember because, we're in the huddle, and Russell's basically like, you know, Hail Mary. You know, and he called a slide protection, so you know, they're only rushing three, so I'm kind of drop back, just, you know, looking for somebody free and just waiting. And Russell's, you know, kind of running all over. And then he just bombs it. And, you know, the sick thing in the back of your head, you're like, all right, that's it. Like, you know, no one ever catches those. You know, it's like Flutie and then Russell. Ironically, both 5'8", you know?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, and then Golden came down with it, and I was like, no, it's an interception. And then they called it to Golden. I was like, oh, my God, crazy. Like, I couldn't believe it. And then the best part was the next day, new refs, you know?
Yeah, new refs the next day. You've played with Russell Wilson, played with Peyton Manning. How are those guys?
Great. They're great. Very different. Very different from each other.
What separates them? Give me an idea of a good anecdote of Russell, what kind of guy he is, and then what kind of guy Peyton is.
I think, well, just on the surface page, just to, you know, observe low vibration frequencies, height and years,
yeah,
kind of separate them the biggest. But and then just on the thing, I think they both have that same, you know, they have that same dedication though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think obviously, you know, nothing personal, Russell, but Peyton is way beyond him with that,
yep,
and kind of with his knowledge. He's, you know, Russell is still learning, but trust me, Russell wants to learn the game and is a great student of the game. So I see that same drive in both of them. And then now clearly the difference is we're talking style of play. Like Peyton is a stand up 6'5", you know, pocket passer, and Russell is a very shifty, quick, smaller run and gun type, you know? And I think that would be the biggest difference I would see in their play style.
You know, I covered Seahawks Cardinals that Thursday night game a couple of weeks back, and I hadn't seen the Seahawks in person. That defensive backfield with Sherman and Thomas and Chancellor and Browner, they are punishing. Just talk about this Legion of Boom real quick and what you think of those guys as a defensive backfield.
I think I always liked those guys at Seattle, and Sherman is one of my good friends and was one of my good friends in Seattle.
Is that right?
And,
tell me about, yeah, let's talk, yeah, about Richard Sherman, because I feel like, I don't know if it's a media creation or if it's real, this kid. He seems like he says whatever he wants and doesn't really care,
yeah,
about anybody.
Yeah, he does. And the problem with Sherman is that he's very, very intelligent. He went to Stanford.
The problem.
And well, I mean, the problem for, you know, people who might not like outspoken NFL players, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so the thing that could scare people a little bit with Richard is he's very intelligent. He knows what he's doing. He's very conscious of what he's doing. And I think that's the great thing about him. And it's, you know, it's why not? If you can make more money or you can get more publicity or you can, you know, endorsements or whatever, that's business. And I think that's kind of what he's working right now. And, you know, the whole defensive backfield at Seattle is just, even the, you know, there's backups. Walter Thurman, I was just talking to him the other day, and great back, very, very talented, and as well as Byron Maxwell, who's another backup. So that was always the thing that I liked about Pete's defensive schemes, is that he really likes to get a really talented, big defensive backfield, you know?
If those two teams, Seahawks, Broncos, meet in MetLife Stadium for the Super Bowl, I don't care who you're rooting for, but who's going to win that game?
That's so tough. Honestly, Peter, I feel like I should get some sort of like a Super Bowl spot, because,
yeah,
if this is a Super Bowl, like I'm like the only man in the world that might know.
We'll have you on. We'll have you on that week.
Let's do it. So, no, I've been asked this question, and it's very difficult for me, because I see, you know, first of all, I look at Denver, and you got Peyton, and that offense, and what Peyton's able to do is unbelievable to me. I've never seen anything like it. I was so impressed when I first got there. But Seahawks have a great defense, and so there's a great matchup. And then I think if you, on the other side of the coin, you look at that offense, Seahawks offense versus, you know, that Denver defense, I would say that maybe the Seahawks would get the best of them. So it's really tough to say, honestly. I think it would be an amazing game. I really couldn't tell you who would win that game.
You know, in the past 2 weeks, we've seen John Fox and Gary Kubiak go down with health reasons. From your side as a player, talk about the stresses a head coach might have in the NFL and how much hours these guys work and what kind of pressure might be on them that the fans might not recognize.
Yeah, you know, I was really shocked by John, too, because it's very ironic. About 2 weeks before I left, I was just like, man, you know, Fox is in good shape, man. You know, he's an older guy, but he's in pretty good shape. Good for him. You know, because a lot of coaches, you see, because this is a lifestyle, you know, a lot of coaches are out of shape because they're always working. They never see their families, you know, and they eat bad because it's stress eating, or, you know, there's not, you know, great food around or whatever. So I think that the head coaching job, or any really coaching job in the NFL is very difficult. And whereas maybe we sacrifice more of the physical and a little bit less of the hours in the office, they're in the office all day, all night. I mean, the coaching hours, I remember Tom Cable, he would get in when I was at the Seahawks. I would never get there, even when I was early, never get there before him, because I think he'd get in like 5:30, 6 a.m. or something, and then he wouldn't leave till like 10 or 11. And I was like, that is just, you know, that dedication and that kind of work, if you don't take notice of that, you're ignorant.
I mean, you know, John Gruden was always famous for setting his alarm at 3:16 a.m. and taking such pride in that. And people always talk about that like it's such a badge of honor. Do you think if the NFL put in rules that said you cannot come into this building until 8 a.m. and you have to leave by 7 p.m., coaches would find a way around it, or they would adhere to it, or what do you think? How would the coaches react to
that? I would want to say that the coaches would not be happy about that because they love it, though. They put in the work, but at the same time, like, they want to do the work. They want to get it done. They know how hard it is to win in this league, and they want – they're very motivated to do it. I've never had a coach that was like, oh, yeah, I guess, or, you know, this maybe. I mean, you know, I had Tom Cable at Seahawks, and I had Dave Magazoo at Denver Broncos, and they were both great coaches and really – cared about every detail, you know?
What was the most alarming or scariest thing you saw in your 3 years as an NFL player where you were just taken aback and said, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
I don't know. You know, there wasn't like anything. Like, I think for me, one thing that was in a lot, I mean, I blew my knee out. That was a big one for me. And then I was kind of like, yeah, that's alarming. I think to me, just where I got to the point where I really looked at the whole lifestyle and I was like, this is just not a lifestyle that sets you up for the future at all. Like this. And I just said, you know, there's a lot in life that I want to do and I'm wasting my 20s not doing it. And it's you know, you kind of live by the NFL, you know, you get the off season, but still you have to train. And, you know, I've been away from my family for a long time and, you know, it really does run your life. And it makes you, for me, some people do it better. I was super selfish when I was playing football because I was hurting all the time. And all I cared about was my little bit of time I got every day. And, you know, I really didn't care about the people around me as far as like, you know, wanting to see me or not, or, you know, and it kind of took away from, you know, people that were closest to me, I felt. And even they never said anything. They were great, but you can sense that, you know?
You are wise beyond your years, my man. And hearing you talk this way at, what are you, 27 right now?
I'm 27 right now.
It's incredible perspective to hear it. It's almost like you're a 40-year-old man talking in that body, and that's impressive. If you were to have a 22-year-old kid, let's say a senior at Iowa or Wisconsin, come to you and say, I'm going to be a fourth or fifth round pick, I'm excited to play in the NFL, what would be your one piece of advice for this young man?
I would tell him to make sure that he looks out for himself above everything else. You know, and I would never discourage anybody to not, you know, if you want to play your passion, go play. You know what I mean? But always make the right decision for you, you know, not for, because in this game, you have to do it. You have to make the right decision for you because nobody else is stepping out on that field.
Any regrets from your 3 years in the league? Anything you didn't do or you would have done differently?
You know, I probably wouldn't have taken Adderall my rookie year. That probably would have been a big one. I got suspended for 4 games. That was a regret. What else? I think. No.
Why'd you take the Adderall? Just to stay up and study, or was it to enhance?
No, I didn't know. I didn't realize that.
Were you taking it in college also?
I had taken it. I had like a prescription at a time, but then I didn't need it. I stopped taking it, and then I just, you know, I didn't know clue it was an illegal thing.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, kind of was taking it and then on and off or whatever, and just not conscious of it, and just wish I kind of like thought for a second about that.
Why do NFL players take it, especially in that Seattle locker room? It seems like there was a rash of, you know, Adderall stuff the last couple of years. Why are people taking Adderall? What does it do for a player?
I can honestly tell you, I never took it for that, in any way related to football. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was like a focus thing or whatever, you know, like in college, it helped, you know, cool me down a little bit when you're getting, and so, who knows in college, maybe some of it was just the drinking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
you're drinking all the time and you're kind of like already, you're going to college and you're in and out and you're tired and maybe you just needed that. You know, I don't know. You know what I mean? But after a while, I figured I'm like, all right, I'm good. But, you know, I don't know why guys take it, and I know. But at the end of the day, the truth with Adderall is that it is like it's immersed in our culture. You know, it's like everybody's taking this stuff.
I think it's your generation, man. I think it's something that was in colleges and now everyone takes it. But like, you know, I'm a little older than you. I don't think the guys my generation and older really know what Adderall is or see it that way. And I certainly don't understand it. And, you know, for studying for a late night exam, like, I get it that way, but to be taking it on a Tuesday, I just don't understand what the value is of this drug.
So what I have heard as far as like, because, and you know, I never did it on the field or never around football. But if I have heard that guys that do, it's because I guess maybe it's a focus on the field and like, you know, the zeroing in on the field. I heard it's very prevalent in baseball as well.
Okay.
I heard guys go, you know, they're playing for 3.5 hours and they're like, you know, they got to stay tuned in. And I've noticed if you ever look at dugouts sometimes, you see guys that are just like that 1,000-yard stare just right on the pitcher. And you're like, that dude's probably on Adderall, you know? So I think that that's probably what it brings. But I think you're exactly right. I think it is a generational thing.
What?
And when I say immersed, I'm probably talking about all the people that I've.
Yeah. You know, was it a Seahawks thing?
No, I don't. It wasn't. Not with me. And I don't want to say with those guys. You know, and some guys there's a lot of guys in the NFL that have a prescription for Adderall that are legitimate ADHD.
Yep.
You know, and so who knows how it can blend up in the locker room and do stuff like that. But like, you know, like with Adderall, it's like, you know, I used to take Adderall in college and read like 3 books. You know, and that's how I looked at it. Like, yeah, you just, you know, get the college work done and that's it. So. In the locker room, I'm not exactly sure of the dynamic, but I know what you're saying with Seattle, because clearly it was me, it was, you know, and 3 other guys on Seattle, and it does not look all that, you know.
Yeah, and
it doesn't look all that good.
And Jim Harbaugh had a comment this offseason, took a little dig at the Seahawks when everyone was pumping up the Seahawks. He had a comment, I don't have it on me right now, but he made an allusion to, he talked about it. Hey, they, you know, they've got some issues over there with the Adderall or whatever it was, and, you know, that made major news. You don't think it's a Seahawks problem, though? You think it's just a league-wide thing?
I think it was definitely an issue that the Seahawks had. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there were multiple guys like with that, myself included. But I don't think it's a thing where we're going to say like culturally the Seahawks are on this and they're going to stay on it and keep on it. I think any issues, I think they were dealt with, and you know, that was it. And I know, you know, when I had my thing, I talked to Pete and I talked to Tom. And I thought they were pretty great. I was going through a rookie year and a knee injury and a difficult time in my life. And they said, are you okay? You know, do you need any help? And, you know, I talked to a couple people and then that was it, you know? And so I wouldn't think it would be fair to label them as like, you know, that kind of a team culture.
My last question, you know, everyone's talking about the culture of an NFL locker room, and I say that with sarcasm because I think it's just a headline that we're seeing everywhere on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. Everyone's talking about the culture of the locker room. In that locker room, forget bullying. If there's a guy who's feeling depressed, you know, you say you blew your knee out, you're probably feeling pretty down. Is that a place where you can go to others for mental health reasons, or is that a huge, huge gap from what is needed in that locker room and what is being provided at the moment?
I don't think I could talk about the rest of the NFL, but I know for a fact that in the Seahawks locker room, there are some great guys that I could always go talk to, you know, and more specifically. So in the Seahawks locker room, there's an equipment manager who runs all of the team equipment. His name's Eric Kennedy. And we have a player personnel gentleman named Mo Kelly. And between the two of them, and also Pete brought on a guy named Dirk Eldridge, who's like almost like a counselor, you know, kind of that thing, but a very, very downer, very, very cool guy. And between those three guys, anytime I really had anything, I could always go to talk to them, and they were really, really great. And, you know, I had my rookie year, I had a very good friend of mine, like childhood friend, kill himself. And so I was going through a really difficult time, and they couldn't, you know, all of them together were awesome and just a great support system. So for me, in my experience, I think that I was very well taken care of on that side. I don't know though, because every organization is so different. You know, the locker room in Denver, which was a great locker room too, not, you know, but I didn't have those kinds of problems. I didn't need Denver like that. And, you know, the locker room in Denver was so different than the locker room in Seattle, which I'm sure is so different than a San Francisco locker room and so on.
Yeah, and then when you see something with Miami, now if there was a rookie teammate of yours getting bullied by one of your other veteran teammates, would you have had the courage or would you have had the gumption to stick up and say, hey, that's enough? Or is that just not really the case in these locker rooms? A rookie gets it and that's just what it is.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a rookie gets it. But I think there is a line. And I would like to say, and I'm sure that I'm sure guys didn't know about phone calls like that. Who knows? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I would like to say that if I heard about a guy making racial slurs towards another man on our team, rookie or not, I think that's the line. You know what I mean? But other than that, I think it's, you know, it's good to tease rookies in a playful way, you know, give them a hard time, make them do some menial tasks. It's kind of a part of the thing. And I did it when I was a rookie. I had Robert Gallery, and he was, you know, he made you do the menial little things, and he taught you and the whole thing, but he was great. And it actually, you know, it's all part of kind of getting into the system. You know what I mean?
I get it. I think for the rest of the country, it's a little hard to figure that out. Okay, before we leave, tell me, what's next for John Moffitt?
So I want to do radio. I want to get into radio. I love talk radio.
Sports or political or what?
If anything, well, I don't really believe in politics, but in a political arena, yeah, or maybe like a social arena or you know, something like that. With I'm not too geared towards sports. You know what I mean?
Who would be the kind of host that you would measure yourself and say that's the kind of guy I want to be? That guy.
I'm a huge podcast fan.
Okay.
So I'm a big Joe Rogan guy.
Oh, I love it. All right. Stuff.
You know, I think he's so open, and I would like to do something like that. Maybe not on radio. I do want to do a podcast too. And I'm actually getting that process. I was going to do that 2 months ago before I left for Denver. I was going to do it in Seattle and interview Seahawks, but just basically the concept will be get athletes on my show, but we're just going to talk about life. You know what I mean? We're going to talk about, you know.
Do you know Brendan Iambadejo at all, former Raven player?
No, I don't. But he had a show, didn't he?
Brendan does a lot of stuff for Fox Sports, but he's very similar where he is an athlete. He is an ex-athlete. He wants to talk social values and social stories and political stuff with other athletes. I think it's very interesting to hear those conversations because Brendan was one of the first players to come out who was pro-gay marriage, and that opened up a conversation in the Ravens locker room, and it was just a fascinating story altogether how such a toxic topic in the public sphere became a topic that guys in the locker room were talking about fairly openly. And I see the way you're going on this road, and I feel like you might want to be a similar track where, you know, let's talk about the public issues, not just sports. I'm not just a dumb jock.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. I really would like to talk about things going on in the world, the public stuff. You know, I just think it's because I've been in sports for so long that, you know what I mean? It's kind of, I'd like to explore new things. So I'm trying to get in the radio. I have a few offers and stuff like that. And then I'm setting up a podcast studio in my house, and I'm pretty excited about that too.
That's great. Your lasting legacy on the NFL. When 10 years from now, people meet you on the street, they don't know your name offhand. You say, I'm John Moffitt. They say, oh, you're the guy, blank. What do you want that to be?
Not to be rude, I don't care.
Yeah.
Because I just, it's just my, you know, I've been reading this great book, Doors of Perception, right? It was what inspired Jim Morrison, okay? And all he talks about is realistically, all you have is your own perceptions. And you can only explain to someone your perception, but they'll never really have it. They'll only grasp the explanation of it, you know what I mean, from their perception. So to me, this whole thing is my own perception, and I'll try to explain the best I can to everybody else why I do what I do. But at the end of the day, it's if you don't understand it, it's just because you don't understand it, you know?
I got you, man. I have my own perceptions as well. All right, we're going to wrap it
up.
You're the man. This is great. Hey, good luck with everything down the line. I'm so glad you came on with us today. And Super Bowl week, if it's Broncos, Seahawks, you're coming on the show again.
I'm in.
Love it. John Moffitt, everybody. Thank you so much, John. Good luck with everything.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
All right, that was John Moffitt, another offensive lineman named John who made some news last week. Interesting guy for sure. I wish him all the best. It takes a lot of courage to walk away from a $3 million contract to go do podcasting. Trust me, I hope it all works out for him. I'm excited. Our next guest is a guy that I've looked up to for a long time. One of my favorite writers in the NFL, and really, really an awesome dude off the beat as well. A guy that I could catch up with and talk about just about anything with. Sam Farmer from the LA Times. Sam, what's up, man?
How you doing, buddy? thanks so much for having me on your show.
What'd you think of John Moffitt? Were you listening to that at all?
Yeah, really interesting. I was particularly interested in the Adderall thing because I just don't get that.
Is that me? Is it a generational thing? Like,
yeah,
I didn't take Adderall as a college guy. I don't know.
I didn't. You know, had I taken Adderall as a college guy, I probably wouldn't be a sports writer. I'd probably gotten decent grades. But you know, and I'm thinking, I wonder what Adderall would do for my leads.
Right. Right. Suddenly you're a lot sharper, a lot wittier, or maybe really focused.
Yeah. No, I have wondered about that, though, and how that affects your focus. And maybe, you know, I guess I could see it for like a defensive back, but, you know, for alignment, I don't know. But it's interesting. I liked your line of questioning. I was really curious about that.
All right, Sam, you are the NFL columnist for the LA Times. Everyone can read him in the Chicago Tribune. They always have your picks there as well.
Oh, God.
They do. Sam, look, you are an institution. Give us a background on, because I know you covered the Raiders for, I guess, San Jose Mercury News for a while,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I did that for 5 years. Covered the Raiders. Well, first I started in Seattle, went to school in L.A. at Occidental College, worked in L.A. for a couple of years, and went to Seattle for 5 years, where I covered University of Washington football and sort of the rise and fall of the Huskies program, and I covered the Seattle Supersonics for 2 seasons.
Oh, that's cool. There's a Super Bowl press conference every year. It's probably, I think it's on the Thursday morning, and it's Goodell addresses everyone, and then you can ask questions. I've been to the last 5 or 6, whatever, and about 3 questions in, everyone can put it in the books. Here comes the Sam Farmer LA football team question, and you always ask it, and Goodell even made a joke about it, like, all right, Sam, let's ask the question. But for those not in those press conferences and those not aware, what is the current state of an NFL franchise coming to L.A.?
Well, I don't think there's any, as I said before, I don't think there's any movement toward that, any serious movement. Let's back up for a second. It really has to do with the stadium. There's no public money here for a stadium, no appetite to commit any public money in a city that's broke and a state that's broke. For a stadium. So, and you have the Rose Bowl, you have the Coliseum. Neither of those work as NFL stadiums. So, you know, there was a real push for a downtown. AEG made a push for a downtown stadium next to Staples Center. Then Tim Leiwicki, who was really driving that train, moved on.
Yeah, he was replaced as CEO, right?
Yeah, he went on to Toronto. And so that lost a lot of steam. There's a guy, Ed Roske, a billionaire developer, who is pitching a site and has been for the last 5 years about 15 to 20 miles east of Los Angeles. That's been sitting out there forever, and nobody's – it's got no takers.
Let's talk Raiders, because I know you were there during some interesting years with Al Davis, and I think everyone on the outside hears – Al Davis stories, but doesn't really know what Al Davis was like. What was it like dealing with Al Davis on a daily basis from 95 to 2000?
Well, you know, it was fascinating. It really was, and it was a total grab bag about what I'd get. Now, I wouldn't see him every day.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't see him around the facility every day, but I'd see him a lot, and sometimes he'd be great with me, and sometimes he would ice me out so bad. I remember one time I was at the owners' meetings in Coral Gables down in South Florida, and I saw Al in the lobby.
Now, everyone, for the listeners, if you're a local beat guy and you see the owner, there's supposed to be some camaraderie there and there's some friendship.
Yeah.
All right, but go on.
Yeah, I see him in the lobby. I said, hey, Al, can I talk to you for a second? He said, come up to my suite.
Wow.
And I said, this is awesome. I'm at the Hyatt Coral Gables. I'm going up to Al Davis's suite, and I get up there, and I see there's a bench up there and weights, and they're just loaded up. I mean, now he had weights brought with him on the road, like free weights. And everybody kind of joked because it was just kind of for show.
That, yeah, like what?
Yeah, exactly. So I said, Al, I see your weights there. You got your weights? And he goes, yeah, it's hard to stay cut at my age. I about fell over laughing, but he was dead serious. But yeah, so Al. But then another time, I was at another owner's meeting, And I was talking to somebody from the NFL, and I'm taking notes and writing down, and Al comes by, and he kind of shovels past me. He says, "Sam, they keep lying, and you keep writing it."
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of rebel was this man? Because I think a younger generation that's getting into the NFL now hears some stories but doesn't know just how much of an outcast and a rebel that Al Davis was.
You know, he was, absolutely, no question. But in his later years, it was weird. There was like this detente between Al and the NFL. Obviously, Al, his method of negotiation was litigation forever, you know, but he really sort of calmed down on that in his later years. And he was extremely bright, you know, very, very knowledgeable about football, very much a manipulator with people, struck fear in the hearts of a lot of people around the league, but, you know, had a sense of humor and everything too. But it was a really interesting time. I mean, I'm trying to think of something to put it in perspective here, but he would sit behind us, the beat writers, on the road, and you'd hear him. Well, first of all, I mean, the years I covered him, you'd hear him just constantly swearing, because he knew, and you'd hear these rings, you know, because he'd wear these. He wore a lot of jewelry, and he wore Super Bowl rings and everything, and just slamming against his desk behind you. But other times he'd say, you know, like, the safety's 2 yards deep. He's 2 yards too deep, you know, or whatever. He would identify something so precise and such a nuanced thing, and all of a sudden the safety'd get burned.
I mean, it's such an interesting thing because people look at Jerry Jones, they say, oh, he's got too much meddling with the business of the football, and he's not a coach. Al Davis was a football coach. I mean, Al Davis knew football.
He totally knew football, especially defense. And, you know, he could identify a problem very quickly, and all of a sudden that player's getting burned on something, you know. So it's like he knew defense, and that was a big thing. If you were a defensive coordinator of the Raiders, you knew that Al was going to hang out at your meetings, and you know, I totally believe that Al was up there, you know, sending down plays occasionally. And players have told me that stuff would come in, some wacky something would come in, get run into the huddle, and clearly it was coming from Al, that he wanted to see this. And so, but, you know, all the players refer to him as Mr. Davis. They're very respectful. He quietly, I think, helped a ton of players. It was sort of once a Raider, always a Raider. But if you crossed him or betrayed him, then you were always the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And, but a fascinating, I mean, he's fascinating to cover. He really was. And every year we'd have a State of the Al address where he would talk. He'd go on for an hour and a half, and all these non sequiturs and weird tangents and great lines that would come out of these press conferences. But it was fascinating, too. I mean, he was like a living history of the league.
I mean, so, he was the artifact. I mean, he had it all from the AFL to this. You've dealt with just about every player and owner and coach in the league. What to you is the future? And you're going to hate this question, and you've probably met the man, but news came out this week that Tebow was signing an agent to represent broadcast. What's Tim Tebow's future?
Boy, I don't think there's a playing future.
Done, right? I think he's done.
Yeah. You know, obviously the guy is a phenom. I'll give you just a little story. There's a group of guys from L.A. who come to every Super Bowl, and they're the Hollywood guys. A buddy of mine, Jack Jarapito, who's a producer.
Sandler's movies, sure.
All Sandler's movies. So Sandler comes out, and David Spade and Chris Rock and all those guys come out every Super Bowl. And I'm fortunate enough that they let me be a fly on the wall. We have dinner every Friday night before the Super Bowl.
Can you invite me? You're going to be in my hometown of New York this year.
Yeah,
can you invite me?
Okay, buddy. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll do that on Friday night before the Super Bowl. But it's just a great – it's nice. It's a nice group. Well, in Indianapolis, the most recent Super Bowl in Indianapolis – or the only Super Bowl in Indianapolis.
Giants-Patriots a couple years back.
Yeah. I was sitting with a guy who was a big football fan – And a Will Forte, the actor who does MacGruber.
He's got a movie Nebraska with Bruce Dern coming out this week.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Anyway, just a great guy, huge Raider fan, interesting guy, super nice. Anyway, so we're sitting there, and you know, I mean, he's surrounded, but he lives a celebrity lifestyle, whatever. About in the middle of the dinner, we're at Harry and Izzy's there in Indianapolis. Tebow comes in, and he sits down at our table. Will Forte, who's, you know, he pulls
Saturday,
out his,
he's on Saturday Night Live for a decade. I mean,
yeah,
he's not a nobody.
He pulls
yeah.
out his phone and reaches across the table and takes a picture of Tebow. I'm like, are you serious, dude? You know, I mean, maybe I'm talking out of school here, but I thought, wow, even the celebrities are, like, awestruck by this guy. There's something about Tebow that is just so, you know, there's such a charisma to this guy.
Well, you've been in the locker room with him. You've met him several times. What do you think
yeah.
of Tebow? I think he's captivating, and it sounds like I'm almost buying into the myth, but even when he was on the Patriots this year in training camp, after a game, he'd go in the locker room, and you want to talk to Tebow because he's so interesting. Like, he's so yeah. unique from the rest of the guys in that locker room.
He is, and I don't know quite how to wrap my arms around that and what it is about him that his – I mean, he just has this charismatic way about him, and he seems so unflappable in so many ways. You know, you'd think that the guy would – crack under criticism or whatever, but he doesn't, and he's very admirable in that way. I enjoyed talking to him. I haven't talked to him a ton, but I'm impressed by him.
You're in LA, and you were mentioning some of those like celebrity stories. Do you have any others? I love this. Who are some of the big football fans that have reached out to you in Hollywood?
Well, you know, let's see. You know, just that table of guys are all fans. I mean, Sandler's a big Jets fan. Oh, I'll tell you one. We were John Dorenbos, the long snapper of the Eagles, great guy, came out, and I took him over to Happy Madison, which is the Sandler's. You know, they basically have a little house on the Sony
yep.
lot, and it's Happy Madison, which is Sandler's production company. And so, John, if you know John, he's a magician. And so, Jack and I were sitting there. John pulled out a deck of cards and was doing these magic tricks for us. And who's the girl who's I'm bad with this?
Yeah.
She's in Spider-Man. She's the lead love interest in Spider-Man.
Claire Danes?
No, not Claire Danes, but like that.
Jessica Chastain. I don't know. I'm just naming. I could even look it up.
No. Anyway, yeah, I'm screwing it up. Hey, Paige. Paige, who's the girl in Spider-Man who's like the love interest?
Kirsten Dunst. Yes, I just thought of it. Yep.
Yeah, so she comes in. Sorry about that. She comes in. She's like a huge, you know, he's entertaining her with that. And with the card trick, she's a big fan. And we go down and see Adam Sandler down at his office. And John is just, I mean, he loves Sandler. And
this is the long snapper, Dorenbos. Okay.
Yeah. And so he says to Sandler, he says, who's your favorite player? And Sandler says, you know, he said, my favorite player is when I'm on the sidelines and some guy, an NFL player, looks over at me and sort of nods to me like, hey, what's up? He goes, that guy instantly becomes a
It's true. It doesn't matter how much money or what Sandler's done, yeah, to have that recognition from an NFL player, yeah, is still huge.
He knows who I am. And that's sort of the funny thing, is this fascination that people in Hollywood have with NFL players. And you know, the door swings both ways. You know, NFL players are really into celebrities and impressed by them. And so I thought it was pretty charming, kind of endearing, that Adam Sandler doesn't expect that NFL players
would love that.
Who he was.
You know, yeah, who else loves the NFL? Dennis Miller. I was here in Fox News, and he's talking Steelers. I mean, these guys love the NFL.
Yeah, no, it's really, and one time I was at a Jets, what was it? No, it was a Mangle, so it was Colts Giants. It might have been the first one.
Yeah.
And I was there at the Meadowlands, and I got a call, and again, it was Jack, and he said, "Hey, Adam's down there, down here, and walking around, and can we kind of get a little tour of the sidelines or whatever?"
Awesome.
So yeah, I went down and met him down there, and Adam's like, "This is my friend Kevin," and it's Kevin.
Kevin James, yep.
Yeah, who's another huge NFL fan, and so just, you know, it's fun. It's fun being in LA and seeing that other side of it and the fascination with it.
Let's wrap with your incognito take. You had a great two articles last week, one with Kyle Turley, another one with Cam Cleland, who not everyone knows his name, but really depicted in brutal detail some of the hazing stuff he took on, where he lost an eye because he was getting beaten with, what was it, a bag of soap? I mean, that was like Full Metal Jacket type stuff.
Oh, yeah, I know. A guy, Andre Royal, linebacker, basically Cam Cleland was a rookie with the Saints. Former Washington tight end, great tight end, who I had forgotten this, but he was runner-up to Randy Moss as NFC Rookie of the Year in 1998. And so, yeah, they had this thing in New Orleans called the Gauntlet, and they would line up all the rookies at the end of one hall at the dormitory at training camp. And about 50... or 60 Saints players, who were, half of them were blitzed, would each get a shot, a punch, a kick, whatever, at a rookie who would run down through the gauntlet. And the rookie had a pillowcase pulled over his head. So when Cam went through, you know, a guy punched him in the nose, broke his nose, he kind of ducked his head down, and this Andre Royal, who was at the end of the line, had a sock, and he had been collecting coins all day from players, and so he had a sock full of coins, and swung it, hoping to hit Cam Cleland around the rib area, and Cam ducked his head, and it hit him in the face, and shattered his eye socket, and he went half blind in that eye, and still is. Almost lost the eye entirely. And so he had some real strong feelings about hazing and that kind of stuff. And he had strong feelings about Richie Incognito, too, having played with him with the Rams later in his career.
And what'd he say about Incognito?
You know, he called him a scumbag.
Scumbag.
And said that this guy was trying to fight everybody in the locker room and had no respect for him. And, you know, this is really an interesting guy, and I don't know Richie Incognito, but I think it's a really puzzling situation, because you have a lot of people in the media who like this guy. Obviously,
he won the Dolphins local beat writer's Good Guy Award last season for always being so available to the media.
Yeah, and so and you have other people who really dislike him, and not just opposing defensive linemen, which is pretty common to have a defensive lineman who feels an offensive lineman is cheap. You hate the guy. But you have guys who are former teammates who really dislike the guy strongly. And so it's hard to draw a bead on, and there are people I respect on both sides of it. So I almost have to reserve judgment in some regards, although I think the messages were deplorable. I mean, there's no There's no two ways around that. And I think the league, I thought, you know, it took a long time for Stephen Ross to come out and condemn what was in those messages, but I think the league was losing credibility by the minute.
Every passing day that there was no comment.
They didn't come out and make a comment and say, listen, we'll get to the bottom of this situation and we'll find out who's responsible for what. But in the meantime, let us just say that this is, because you think about how could the league with a straight face ever do any kind of anti-bullying PSA, for instance?
Sam, how could they show the bullying scenes on or the rookie initiation scenes on Hard Knocks moving forward? You can't.
Yeah, no, you can't. And that's another thing, bringing up Hard Knocks. What a treasure trove of
evidence. It's just evidence.
Unprecedented treasure trove that they can go through and say
hazing.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, and we saw the stuff that's already come out, the iPad stuff and that kind of thing. And there's, you know, it seems much, much more insidious once you see some of those messages.
Where do you think this happens? What goes on with this the next couple of weeks? I mean, where do you see it playing out?
I think that I think Jeff Ireland's probably going to lose his job. I think that I can see Roger Goodell coming down very hard on Incognito with a major, major suspension, possibly an open-ended suspension. I think there will be fines. I think, you know, if you look at the history of the commissioner who's you know, biggest sort of piece of legislation, if you will, if you're not talking about the ending the lockout, but his biggest thing is the personal conduct policy.
Yep.
And a guy who's been unafraid about handing out serious, serious suspensions to, you know, star players.
Look at Ben Roethlisberger. Yeah.
Michael Vick or Dante Stallworth or some of these people or the Bountygate stuff. I don't think Goodell will be shy at all about lowering the boom. So, and then in the long term, I think the league is going to try to sort of legislate hazing, and that would be outlawing any semblance of, you know, it might be a team-by-team basis, but I think, you know, or in other words, leave it up to the teams, but I think that Goodell probably won't want to see rookies paying for these big meals.
$30,000 dinner. It's like when you take me out. It's not fair. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, well, you know, that's true. It's just, you know, I think the league's going to come down hard on anything that resembles hazing. And so we're going to see some lasting effects from this. This will not be swept under the rug by the NFL.
All right. I think there's a lot more to come out also. I think we saw the first side from Incognito. We'll get some Martin. And if you're tired of this story and you're fatigued by it 8 days, 9 days in, just buckle up because it's not going anywhere.
Yep. Totally agree.
All right, my man. Thank you so much, Sam Farmer. Hey, seriously, Garaputo, Sandler, Spade, Farmer, Schrager. Can we make this happen?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll pick up the tab, the $30,000 dinner tab.
Yeah,
I don't mind. It's worth it. That would be a bucket list thing for me. But thank you so much for coming on. I know it's early on the West Coast. You are the man. Everyone, Sam Farmer, LA Times. Sam, what's your Twitter handle? It's always a good one.
LA Times Farmer.
LA Times Farmer. And next time you're out here in New York, you, me, Greg Gutfeld, we'll all get together.
That'd be great. I love that guy.
All right, guys. Sam Farmer, an awesome read every day in the LA Times, then also on Twitter. Thanks so much, dude.
My pleasure, bud. See you, Pete.
And that's our episode for this week. Two very interesting guests, John Moffitt and Sam Farmer. Big NFL week up ahead of us. I will be doing Titans Colts Thursday night, and then I'm making my debut on the NFL on Fox sideline Sunday. Tampa versus Atlanta, but you know that's not the big game. The big game is Denver, Kansas City, and as of this moment, I'm seeing Dwayne Bowe, star wide receiver for the Chiefs, arrested. Let's see how that one plays out. The NFL, where positive headlines just keep coming in. Till next week, everybody. Thanks so much, and keep on listening. Appreciate it.